to Muffin Talk.
Kia ora and welcome to Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is a weekly radio program to which I invite guests to talk about their work and their passion for issues on community programs, social justice, Bible studies, or interfaith relations. Today I've invited Helen Shamrod to a Zoom recording for broadcast. Helen, a warm welcome and hi to my radio program.
Good morning, Morena.
Helen Shamrod is an Auckland artist who makes textile arts, but has also created amazing steel fiber artwork. For example, the installation New World, Old Story. In 2005, she was appointed an officer of the New Zealand Order of Merit for services to the arts. Helen, how did you first get involved in art that is based on textiles and steel fiber?
Well, I used needle and thread from the time I was 2 years old, when my mother had no, we were traveling through Europe post-war, and she didn't have anything for me to play with. So she would give me a handkerchief and a needle and thread and some buttons, and she showed me how to stitch buttons onto the handkerchief. And then at night, she would cut it all off and give me the same handkerchief, the same buttons, and a new piece of cotton to learn to sew these buttons on. And so that sewing became integral to my education all the way through, even through my architectural studies and so on. I was always interested in that very fundamental needle and thread. And then at home with young children, I was knitting, I was doing macrame, it was just starting at that stage. I was doing a whole lot of things with my hands with threads. It was safe around small children because when I wanted to do things like screen printing, they would have created havoc around it. And if I'd worked with other media, it would have been a lot more dangerous. So I could always have something on the go. And so once I started doing it, I realized that this was known as women's work. And I wanted to legitimize it and say, it's not just women's work. Women make art out of these things. And so it was that my early feminism came out, and I started making artworks that used textile medium. That evolved over a number of years to using textile processes, those same processes I've been doing, but using other materials. So I might knit with fuse wire. I did a lot of works where I knitted fuse wire and silk thread, and then I painted the silk thread with dyes, and so it had this duality of the hard and the soft. And the hard and the soft became quite important to what I was doing. So that evolved and evolved, and eventually I tackled working with steel, which was a real challenge. And in later projects, I did very much mixed media, and if a project needed cast glass, I went and worked with a glass artist, and we produced cast glass for that project. So in the installation that I did, 18 for Life, 10 to Remember, I used stitched silk, a big hanging, but I also produced 18 glass containers for Yahrzeit candles, the memorial candles. And this was definitely a Holocaust memory, because my parents were Holocaust survivors. So that's a long answer to a short question.
Well, but you've already led to the next question. I would like to know, what is the role of religion that has played in your artwork? Because you've just mentioned some of your background. Can you tell us more about the role of religion in your artwork?
Well, for a long time, religion was not part of my artwork. I grew up in an environment just post-war in Australia, where I had spent my childhood, where I felt the need to keep my head down and try not to be obvious because newcomers weren't very welcome. And I had to learn English in a big hurry because I spoke French after we'd lived in Belgium. And I kept my religion as part of me, but not visible in my outer life, in my more public, in the public space. And it was when I started making artworks where I was looking at, this is years later in New Zealand, and I was looking at what was significant in Maori art and what was significant in Aboriginal art back in Australia, that I started to examine, okay, so for me, what is it? And I realised that although I didn't have the country as backup, because we'd moved quite a lot since I was a baby in Poland, I had to identify myself in another way, and I realised it was my Judaism that identified me. And I made a work prior to that big installation where I had some Jewish motifs, and it's a work that sits at Beth Shalom in the foyer. And the thing about that was that it had some motifs, ancient and contemporary, but they were embedded in this matrix that it just looks like an abstract until you start to come up close.
What is it exactly?
It's a mixed media assemblage. It's in a frame. And the thing about it was that from a distance, it just looks like an abstract work. But when you come up close, you start to identify the small motifs. And this was me as though I was emerging into saying who I am, and I was saying it in a safe place embedded in this work. So from there, I need to jump to the fact that my mother was an artist, and she had always, after what she went through, all she was interested in was doing beautiful things with birds and rainbows and sunshine and flowers. You know, she wanted the joy of life to be in her work. And then one day she told me that she was doing a big mural for the outside of a synagogue in Melbourne, and one of the panels was going to be about the Holocaust. I was stunned, absolutely. She showed me the sketches and so on. And I came back and I thought, if my mother can do it, I need to. So I made my first work absolutely focused on where I had come from. And that work sits at Auckland Museum in the Holocaust room. And it looks like a stack of burnt books, or it looks like a stack of bricks, and that implies gas chambers. There's a torn area at the bottom, and there's a little golden Star of David, a Magen David, that I embroidered. So here's the embroidery. It comes back in. Mm-hmm. And that was the work. That was my first work out there that said, this is my heritage. So from there on, it came into exhibitions that I did where I researched pre-war Europe, wartime memories of my parents, the fragments that I gained. And I did a number of works that focused on that. In parallel to that, I was being invited to design some elements for two synagogues in Auckland. The Orthodox community came and commissioned me to do some things for them, to design a silver crown to sit on top of a Torah scroll, a curtain for the ark, and then later they came back for more. And in the meantime, I was doing things for Beth Shalom, which is my community. And at Beth Shalom, I designed a tree of life, which is in the foyer. And it's, and the thing about that was that it's glass on glass. And we add a glass little panel commemorating the good and the difficult and the challenges and the losses and the loves and the births and so on. And each little leaf is glass on glass on glass. So it's like it's layering what's going on in life there.
And the light can shine through, which is beautiful.
The light shines through, absolutely.
Yes.
And so that was the first major work at Beth Shalom. And I found that I was doing the ritual, the Judaica, which is the Jewish ceremonial and ceremonial works for the community that I live in. And what was interesting was when I discussed the brief, in every context, every time, it was, we want some tradition, but we also want to make it in New Zealand. We want it to be of New Zealand. So that tree of life, the little leaves that get engraved are in the shape of Pahutukawa leaves. Yeah. And the curtains, I've used kōwhai, or I've used niko on the for the crowns. I've done two crowns now for Auckland Hebrew Congregation. And I've done like the flowers that those threads that the Pahutukawa sheds, you know, that red carpet we get every year in summer. So I made that a motif for a cover for the bima, which is the desk on which the Torah scroll is laid and where it's read from. And this was for Auckland Hebrew Congregation as well. So I've done covers. I've designed covers. And
Helen, you also designed the Ner Tamid.
Mm-hmm. I did.
And first of all, before you explain about the Ner Tamid, what is a Ner Tamid?
Okay. The Ner Tamid is an eternal light. It goes back a long, long way historically. Nobody quite knows how it started, but it sits right in front of the Ark. The Ark is what holds the sacred Torah scrolls. And the light shines day and night. Now, historically, it would have been a flame. And in contemporary times, that would be absolutely unacceptable in a building. And a long time ago, once electricity came in, we started to use electric lights and LED lights and so on. So that light is just something that sits there, and it's like a beacon. It sits there in front of the Ark. So we talked about, when we were designing, we were redesigning the whole sanctuary, and we talked about having a contemporary Ner Tamid. So I researched contemporary Ner Tamids and decided that really we weren't going to get things that worked in the Mediterranean or in the United States. We needed something that was of New Zealand. So it's like a folded triangle. So it's three-dimensional, and it sits casting shadows, coloured shadows, because there's a coloured globe inside it, and it has an orange glow that sits there. And the light comes out through some holes in the metal that contains it. And the holes are in the shape of a menorah. And it's the same menorah that shows up around the bima, and it's based on a very old menorah that was found made out of ceramics, I think it's Byzantine the flooring, the hard flooring, the tesserae that they call them, the little tiles, handmade tiles. And so I used the motif, we used the motif around the bima, and we echoed that motif in the corners of the Ner Tamid. And the holes are in the shape of little pahutakawa leaves again. So it's echoing what was happening out the front with the tree of life. And it's the tree, it's the motif that symbolizes, it says this is a New Zealand tree that generated this inspiration. So that, there's three of those. So you see them whichever way you're looking at it. And underneath, there's a motif in the glass sitting underneath of a Star of David. Now, the Star of David, the Magen David, is a much more contemporary motif in Judaism. It doesn't go back anything like as far as the menorah, that particular menorah did. But what it does, it has the past, the relative past, and then the now, which is the light in this very contemporary looking little sculptural piece. It's like a little mini sculpture that hangs there. And I love the way the light just flicks up to the ceiling and you get the shadows of it. And it's kind of symbolic, unintentionally, I have to say, of how that spreads. The light and the love spreads. If you have this pure whole that we believe in, that it goes further. It goes a lot further. So that's basically what it's about. Yes. The other thing, of course, is that I've written about the Ner Tamid because I also do a lot of writing. And I've written about the arts, and I've written a whole lot of things as well. So I've had these parallel careers.
Yeah. And Helen, does every synagogue have a Ner Tamid?
Yes, they do now.
So what happened created yours?
Pardon?
Was there another one before you created the one in Beth Shalom?
Yes, it was quite. I don't know where it came from. Possibly from Israel, possibly. I don't know where it came from, but it was a much more traditional kind of lantern. It looked a bit like a lantern. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what happens with something that belonged to a sacred space and you replace it? Do you put it in a museum or do you?
I honestly can't tell you what happened to it. I was on the design team, but I was not on the team that did that to it. Yes.
And tell me about the design, because it is a work that you did together with
my partner Michael. Yes.
And how was the work together to get the Ner Tamid?
Well, what happens is he is an industrial designer, so it means that he really knows how we can make it work in actual fact. I conceived of what I thought we would like, and our little design team said, yes, go ahead with that. So for me, I did the preliminary sketches and I did the detail, you know, and looked at the details and so on. But when it came to how we would make it, I had some idea, but he had a much better idea. You know, he had much more knowledge in that area about how to make it work. And so we worked together, and what he did was he drew it on the computer. He's much better at that than I am. I'm much better with needle and thread. And together we resolved what we thought this would be. It's an interesting thing. A lot of the works that I've done have been collaborative. A lot of the Judaica, the ritual objects, I've worked with somebody else each time. I bring the vision and the shape of it and what I want, and then together we work out how to do it. I do the design work, but and if there's stitching to be done, I'll be in there. But if but with a curtain that the first curtain, I worked with an artist who did machine embroidery like you've never seen. It's just spectacular. With Michael working on the Netamid, he knew exactly how the bits of perspex would work, and because he was familiar with the materials, I just had this idea of how it might work. But it's working with somebody who has in-depth knowledge. The silver crowns, I worked with people who worked with silver. And it's very enriching, actually, that doing a collaborative process. It means that you get more than the sum of the two parts. You get a whole other thing gets generated, and I think it's invariably better.
I think that sounds wonderful to work together, because it's especially if you do something for your community. So it's
right.
It's not an, you don't prepare an object of art for yourself, but it's for a community. So to have at least one more person involved, that's great.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the things that that comes of wanting a big vision, bigger than I know I can do on my own. And sometimes the other party was a commercial organization that did commercial embroidery or commercially created the curtains, or, you know, because I went to somebody who was expert at it. And to get, and I would get in there completely engaged with every tiny little detail. One of the members came with me when I was, for instance, when I was selecting threads for a Torah mantle, the cover that sits over the Torah scroll, and she watched me selecting yellow threads, and she couldn't believe how many threads there were in that were available, and how we picked out exactly which threads would give the right tonal value. And so those are my skills, but I handed it over to the commercial people to actually put it together for me. And I think that that's what's really interesting, and it's something that comes from with learning in workshops and over the years where I've done a bit of teaching and where I've gone into different environments and realised that how much stronger it is to work with other people than just to be, you know, alone in the studio just doing, which I do for some things, and I love that part of it. I love being in my own headspace working in the studio, or at my desk writing or whatever, and that is done in solitude. But then the other is just enriches the process.
That reminds me very much of what some musicians say, how they have an idea of a musical piece, and then they present it to friends, and then the friends give a little bit of feedback, and then out of that grows the final piece.
And, absolutely.
So
yeah, it's... Well, these are the things that we learn, sometimes by chance and sometimes by design. Yes.
Yes. Thank you so much. It's really interesting. You were mentioning the mantle of the Torah. So is a mantle of the Torah, it's a covering of the Torah, and it's taken, can you tell us a little bit more about the mantle?
Sure. The Torah scroll winds in, it's a double scroll, so you have to hold it together, so there is a fabric strip that holds it together, and then you cover that, you drop, there's two shafts, two pieces of wood that come up through it, and you drop a cover with the two holes on it over the top of it, and the mantle is, it has all sorts of ways of being interpreted, and there are there are mantles internationally that have any number of versions, but usually there is a Jewish motif. There might be a motif that indicates what country it comes from, just by what it is. For instance, you know, the plant life that I've used in different mantles, and there's often an embroidery of some sort, generally commercial embroidery. Sometimes there's some American ones where the assemblages of fabrics on them, that it becomes a textile artwork in itself. And there's sometimes a Hebrew inscription that's chosen, a phrase that embodies what's in it. There's often Jewish motif of some sort. So you're getting like a picture. Sometimes there is an inscription on the back of who donated it.
Oh.
Or in whose honour it was donated.
Yeah.
Sometimes that inscription is inside, and sometimes it's on the outside and forms part of the visual image that you have of it.
Yeah.
And
it's
a protector. In many ways, it protects the scroll. And you lift it off, you read from it during the service each week, and then you put it back on. And then there's another mantle, a white one that gets put on for the High Holy Days. And the white mantle is a separate one again. And I did design one for Auckland Hebrew Congregation that was being donated. And it has a little pomegranate, which symbolises something about the new year, about the timing. But it also has leaves, New Zealand leaves. And I try and embody a little bit of history, yeah, and a little bit of tradition, and a little bit of sense of place.
I find it interesting that the term mantle, because there is a German word called mantel, exactly spelled the same way, and that's the German word for coat. So,
well, this is in English, a mantle is a cover or a coat. It can even be a cover on the land, as far as I know. So yes, it's the cover. And it's possible that it comes from, that word has evolved from the German. I'm sure it has. Yeah. I mean, just English has a lot of derivations from a lot of languages.
Yes, there's a lot of influence one another. So thank you so much, Helen. This interview went so fast.
It did.
Yes. And before we finish, I just want to draw the attention of our listeners to the Exploring Sacred Spaces events. Last year, we did visit Beth Shalom, and you explained a little bit about the mantle, and it was fascinating. This year, we are going to other places. Every year, the Auckland Faith Council is going to different places. So this year, there are four events. Saturday, the 30th of September, we are going to a Hindu sacred space in Mangere Bridge. Saturday, the 7th of October, is a Christian sacred space in Northcote. Sunday, the 8th of October, we're going to an Islamic sacred space in Glendine. And then on the 14th of October, a Baha'i sacred space in Glen Innes. All events are open to everybody. And for more information, the time and the exact place, please go to www.aucklandinterfaithcouncil.org.nz. And this radio program has been brought to you by Titi Ponamu Study and Joy. For more information on this organization, please check out www.studyjoy.nz. Kia kaha, and keep safe. And thank you so much, Helen, for all these insights. It's been fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you.